Welcome to The Thriving Marriage, the podcast for those who want to get their spouse back in love with them and truly thrive.
You'll learn why 95% of people don't save their marriage and the secret method no one else is talking about that will change everything for you. Are you ready?
Are you ready?
Let's turn tragedy to triumph.
Here are your hosts, international marriage experts, Mark Johnston and Heather Choate.
Awesome. Welcome everyone here to The Thriving Marriage. Mark and I are super excited to join you today. Hope that you're doing well and safe wherever you are. I'm here with Mark Johnston. How are you doing, Mark?
I'm doing great. I'm looking at this. We've changed the stream thing here around a little bit, and I was looking up to see, okay, can we actually see the comments? And we might not be able to see the comments today is what I'm getting at here. But
bummer. I always love being able to get your guys' feedback. So hopefully that works out okay. All right. So today, Mark, we're talking about something I'm really excited about. How to handle control issues, especially if you have to deal with a controlling spouse. You know, if your partner has complained about you being controlling, you know, they say you're just so controlling or stop controlling me. We're going to talk about how to deal with all of that today. And I'm really excited about that because it's all about change and progress and awareness. And I'm going through some personal growth right now. As some of you guys know, I mentioned a couple podcasts ago, I'm working on my fitness. And so started a strength training routine and I woke up so stiff and so sore. Like, why am I even doing this? Like, why am I still putting myself through this? The pain of this growth. And that's why it's so important that we hold fast to the outcome that we want. And I was thinking, Mark, I probably shared this here on the podcast before, but there's a really great quote by Robin Sharma. And he says that change is hard in the beginning, messy in the middle, and glorious at the end. And so for all of us that are working to improve and progress in our lives and move forward, we got to know it's hard at the beginning, it's messy in the middle, but it's glorious in the end. So let's hold fast to that vision. Before we get into these control issues though, Mark, want to share with us the client win of the week?
Yeah, so this win is from one of our one-on-one clients. It comes from Steven. He was actually posting to another Thriving Marriage group member's post, and I loved this comment that he made. So Steven says, I'm so sorry that you're going through this. At this point, it will feel hopeless and it will feel terrible. I was at that point 3 months ago. Now, this program helps if you stick with it and if you listen. I've been busy as a single father of two, so it's been hard to find time for the calls and group meetings, but I watch the videos, I read the suggested books and follow podcasts as well as the Facebook public videos, follow steps and believe, and even when it seems hopeless. Nothing is guaranteed, but it helps and seems to work, not just for bettering relationships, but bettering yourself too. Needless to say, I stuck with the program and learned so much, then I applied it. Went from basically my best friend hating me and wanting to move away, we just both notarized letters to withdraw our divorce filing and are moving back in together and going to start marriage coaching sessions together. It felt hopeless for a good while and it hurt so bad, but I never gave up and still believed in love. Stay strong. And there's a kind of a word jumble there, but if the relationship is truly what you want, there's a chance you can make it happen. So the point here, much like Heather was saying, is it looks messy at the beginning. And, you know, if you can stick to it, it can end up being something great. I think a lot of people come into these situations and kind of they come a bit desperate. They really want something to work right away because they're at this really low point in their life. Especially if your partner is trying to pull away from marriage, if they're discussing divorce, I can understand why that would create a lot of panic. And I think a lot of people are looking at this in terms of, okay, how do we make things change right now? And I think the important thing to remember is that for real changes to happen, it's actually healthier if it takes a little bit of time and you have to struggle through it a little bit. it ends up creating healthier, more sustainable circumstances in the long run. So I like this comment here.
Awesome. And congratulations to Stephen. Yeah, it is definitely hard at the beginning, messy in the middle, but you're seeing the light at the end of the tunnel there, that it can be glorious at the end. So it's awesome.
Yes.
All right, so control. You guys here in the Thriving Marriage Facebook group asked us to talk about control issues, and we like to listen to you guys. I'd say probably 80% of our podcast topics are chosen by you all, and we want to be able to help you with what you're going through. And so we know if one or two of you are saying there are definitely control issues in my marriage, maybe I feel like my spouse is controlling me, or I'm getting feedback, maybe I'm being controlling, I don't know if I am, or maybe I do know that I am, that's definitely something that we want to address. Because if a few of you are feeling it, then probably a lot of you are going through this as well. So we always kind of start the podcast in the same kind of way. We like to like define what we're actually talking about. So Mark, we've been helping thousands of couples now all around the world, and we've seen a lot of different patterns, a lot of different tendencies. What have we noticed in working with all these students and clients control really looks like?
Sure.
In these situations?
I like to define these sort of things because I will frequently encounter situations where someone's like, okay, my partner is controlling me, or they're so narcissistic, yeah, or they're bipolar. And there are these words that come out that kind of have this, for lack of a better word, like this damning sort of connotation, like they are doing this terrible, terrible thing. And, you know, I would say controlling is one of these sort of accusations. I like to use appropriate terms because, you know, a situation like if we were to label someone as like narcissistic, that creates a different sort of story in the situation, where the reality might be something like, okay, maybe this person is lacking some social awareness. Maybe this person, and there are frequently less damaging ways to describe the situation. But I would agree that this is controlling if we see some of these signs. So if there's micromanaging behavior, as in like there's detailed instruction on how to do things right, even if that person doesn't have any direct responsibility. So, you know, we might see this with parents, and to a certain extent, we expect this a little bit from parents. But like, you know, you start getting into areas where you don't really have, you shouldn't have that kind of responsibility. If you're a parent of a teenager and you're really starting to dictate what things they have to do with their personal relationships. Once again, to a certain extent, we expect some amount of control from parents, but like it can go overboard. And where that healthy line is really dependent on both people. But we get further into the definition, we'll get into that. So if there's frequent asking of others' behavior or whereabouts, this person is very concerned with things that you are doing, that you're saying, places that you're going, wanting to check in if this is the right thing to be doing or saying, or the place that you're supposed to be being. Now, like I mentioned parents, we're really not gonna focus so much on the parenting control issue, but we're gonna be more looking at this in terms of partners. Now, this is a different situation. If your partner is asking what you're doing and what you're doing and where you are, you know, in many cases, this can be just having open conversation. It's when that sort of questioning leads to accusations and discussions of what you're doing right or wrong. So it's not just the asking, it's not just the conversation. If there's consistent negative emotions in response to disagreements in opinion, so they're asking about your whereabouts, your behavior, and if it's not right, then they're, you know, angry, and perhaps they start crying and get upset. It doesn't have to be this aggressive sort of emotion. It could be the victim sort of emotion as well. Like, how could you go to your friend's house to spend time with them instead of me? And, you know, that's still a kind of if that's done frequently, it can be controlling in the right context, or the wrong context, I should say. If there's a lot of inflexibility in the choices that other people are making, especially if there's low empathy, if they are never able to be wrong, or they have a really hard problem, they have a lot of problems with being wrong in a situation, if they are playing victim when they are the ones that have made mistakes. We can go on and on, but like, do you, a lot of what this is going on about, I think, is this sort of idea right here. It's the inflexibility in what others are doing, and then negative responses to what should be reasonable choices that the other person should be able to make. I'm going to get into some more unhealthy levels, but I want to discuss maybe some examples of some of the things that we've been discussing. Heather, can you think of any, or if you can, I can certainly come up with some. Do you know? Oh, Heather, is Heather there? Oh, wait, okay. You froze there for a second, but you're back.
We thought maybe if Mark hosts this time, then the connection would be better, but it looks about the same probably, so. Oh, well, it is what it is. So kind of what I've seen, Mark, and maybe this is just another way of describing what you just shared, was that there tends to be some really overt types of control that are very easy to see. You know, the very controlling spouse that says, you can't go here, you can't do this, be home by this time, do dinner in this way, and that they're really, really micromanaging, or just very distrustful of their spouse and wanting to exert a lot of control in a very blatant, obvious way, right? Where anyone on the outside could be like, wow, that's a very controlling situation. And then there are the little bit more covert types of manipulation. I'm gonna say manipulation because it's actually another form here of control. Mm-hmm. Not all manipulation is, but there's some manipulation of the passive aggressiveness that we do this kind of dance because we'll do something like this. Like a more covert type would be the silent treatment, right? Or withdrawal of affection. And these kind of behaviors are a means to control your spouse without really coming out and seeming like it, right? You're using this kind of game or this behavior to manage and control what your spouse is doing, to punish them or to move them in a direction that you want them to go. And so just really examine where your relationship is at, and especially where you are at. And I know that in my family, you asked for an example, right? So in my family, I grew up with kind of a pattern here of very controlling women. The women tend to be more controlling and more overtly controlling, like you can really see it, okay? And the men tend to be a little more passive aggressive about it. And so they tend to take this little bit of a covert types of behavior, of withdrawal, of emotional affection, silent treatment, kind of shutting you out, stonewalling, barriers, right? And we get into this very unhealthy pattern. And we're going to go into more unhealthy levels, but having recognized this pattern, and I want to go even deeper after we go through the unhealthy levels into what's really causing this. And I know that we're going to definitely touch on that because there's definitely things that are happening internally inside both partners that we want to grasp any amount of control they can. And we'll go deeper into that.
5 seconds there, Heather. You cut out for just a few seconds.
Okay.
So yeah, there's definitely, what was that?
Yeah, we're definitely going to go deeper into what's really driving these behaviors, because that's really important that we understand the root issues behind what's causing this kind of covert or overt kind of control and manipulation going on. So Mark, what have you seen as far as like some examples of these things?
So, and it's easy to justify some of this controlling behavior, and it's going to be easy to see why this is easy to justify when we get into why people might get engaged in controlling behavior. But you know, one of the things that I tend to recommend against are things like snooping behavior, or you know, I've seen clients who hire a private investigator who go through the journals of their partner, and you know, oftentimes I'll hear justification. Well, like I needed to know whether my partner was, you know, having an affair or not. But these are things that I will often see that don't really look like control, but in some subtle ways that they are, because there's this focus in on what the other person is doing. And part of the problem with this, you know, with control in general, is there is this kind of exertion of like force towards what other people are doing rather than this inward sort of introspective sort of view. Sometimes in psychology, we call this an external locus of control versus an internal locus of control. Like the thing that my circumstances in life are controlled by things outside of myself, or they're controlled inwardly. And this is kind of an odd twist on that, because you might say, okay, well, if I can control these other people, then, you know, this is an inward sort of sense of control. But it's a really unhealthy twist on that. So generally in psychology, it's viewed as more healthy to have that internal sense of control, that my circumstances in life are my own responsibility and a result of my own behavior, versus a general external locus of control. Like it's other people's fault that my circumstances are the way they are. It's other people's fault because they control me, or they do this other stuff, and so now this is why I feel the way I feel. Mm-hmm. And it's a little bit what controlling behavior is trying to do. It's trying to say, well, if I can control what other people are doing, then my life will look better. But it's still this external locus of control. Like I don't have an ability to affect my own circumstances myself quite as much. I don't know if you'll get me. It's this weird twist. It's trying to take that responsibility, but like taking your responsibility and putting that on other people. But yeah, like I said, the some of those behaviors, like the snooping, the reading people's personal information without permission, going through records, like phone records or text messaging records, all those things you might justify saying, okay, I want to see if my partner's cheating, but it is a form of control. So anyways, a lot of this is this kind of idea, like you were talking about, or like we were discussing about this locus of control and, you know, and all of that. I do think that another portion of this control element is the inflexibility, kind of a rightness or wrongness sort of sense, taken to a high level, in terms of like a focus on whether other people are doing the right thing or the wrong thing. And I think that really kind of tips it over the edge a little bit more into those unhealthy levels. So when it gets to those unhealthy levels, we start seeing other behavior. The snooping or the checking in on partners starts to become an obsession. I remember reading, this is a very side example, but in like a parenting group, so my wife and I look at these parenting groups, like how do we deal with pandemic problems in parenting? And someone was bringing up this, they were asking about these troubling journal entries that their child was having. And when that person was questioned about it, this parent was like reading their child's journal on like a daily basis. And we were like, oh, that's really turning into this obsessive behavior. Other unhealthy, where it starts getting really unhealthy, is when there's double standards, as in the controlling partner engages in behavior that they wouldn't allow their partner to do. Like, I'm going to go out and take time for myself. You're not allowed to go do that. You need to stay home with the kids.
Yep.
Or what was that?
Oh, I've seen examples of that one for sure.
Yeah. Maybe reverse, like that tends to be more of a male controlling situation, saying, okay, the wife has to stay home with the kids. But in reverse, we might see it in other things. I'm going to go out and spend time with friends, but how dare you go spend time with friends? Don't you think I'm important? Why would you not want to spend time with me? Why are you prioritizing your friends over me when they themselves are seeing friends at other times? Like I said, going through personal information, diaries, journals, emails, phone records without permission. You know, in my marriage, we have a very open communication sort of thing. My wife and I, we leave our emails open. We have no qualms about checking those things, but there's kind of we have this understanding that that's okay. And it's okay to see each other's phones, and it's okay to see all that. But if you don't have permission, then it turns into this unhealthy behavior. Or lastly, punishing behavior in response to disagreements, especially in an opinion. So you were mentioning, Heather, like silent treatment or, you know, other things like that. Or I'm going to get really upset and I'm going to smash things. You know, when it starts to get into this, I'm doing this because I disagree with what you're doing, it really is turned into this unhealthy point.
Right. Even using other people like your children, manipulating your children to get back at your spouse, you know, manipulating friends, family. There's so many different forms that this can take. So just being really mindful of where we might be straying into the control issues, right? Where we might be straying into some passive aggressive behavior, and where we might be straying into that kind of covert manipulation.
Okay, so I want to sum all this up because we kind of listed a whole bunch of different behaviors. Yeah. And I want to sum it up into a few simple ideas because there's a lot. We kind of just put out a big list.
Yeah.
So I do think that when it's turned controlling, it is gotten to this point where one is trying to take responsibility over things that are not their responsibility. So personal choices, personal opinions, there's that element. And I think there's this inflexibility, the sense of right and wrong. So it's the sense of right and wrong placed externally in areas where you don't really have any responsibility whatsoever. And I think it's those things combined together that create this sense of control. So, and it looks like that very overt, like you were saying, Heather, where I'm going to get upset, I'm going to tell you what to do. And it can also be this covert, what you're doing is wrong. And now I'm going to really show you how upset I am about this and how sad I am. And I'm going to blame you for being insensitive. So it goes in both, you know, both of those, the covert versus the overt, still kind of play on that inflexibility and these, that sense of right or wrong, and placing that sense of right or wrong over someone else and that's what it's all about. We'll start. I heard the question, where does that drive come from? We cut out for 5 seconds. Was there more to that question?
I just repeated it, and I apologize to everyone. I wish I could get better signal here.
But it's just not great. that's really a wonderful question. And this is always, you know, this is what I like about kind of our method here is Heather, you and I, we ask those kind of questions. Like, it would be really easy for us to say, this is unhealthy behavior. Just stop it.
Just stop it.
And, you know, my personal opinion is that a lot of unhealthy behavior has some roots in healthy desires, some reasonable desires here. And it's the same thing with an extreme amount of control. It does come from reasonable needs. I do think that control comes from a desire to have an additional measure of order and security. Basically, the controlling person often says, okay, if I can manipulate this person, if I can control them, then I will feel more secure. And we see this in both the covert and the overt. The covert, like, I'm going to tell them how upset I am. I'm going to be really sad. I'm going to play the victim because they went out and saw some friends. And then, therefore, I will feel more secure in my relationship because he'll spend more time with me. And oftentimes, basically, like this controlling behavior, it's a way to reduce anxiety, it's a way to reduce stress, it's a way to feel more secure. And these are the healthy, reasonable needs that are, we don't want to necessarily shut down. And if you can approach it from that, like, my partner wants to feel more secure. They want to feel less stressed. They want to feel less anxious, rather than my partner is this monster. You're going to be off to a much better start. And this goes into, you know, what we were talking about, I think a couple weeks ago, Heather, the pursuer and avoider sort of dynamic, where the, and I do think that the pursuers are going to be more the people who have more of the controlling behavior. But they're much like in that dynamic, that pursuer-avoider dynamic, if you just push back against the person that is pursuing, like, no, I'm not going to connect with you. No, I'm not going to give you what you want here, or, you know, vice versa. Or if you say to the avoider, no, I'm not going to give you this piece, I'm going to keep chasing after you, you're going to cause problems. Much like this person who's controlling, if you say, no, I'm not going to provide some security for you, I'm not going to support you with feeling less anxious, their likelihood is that they're going to double down on their attempts at control.
Exactly. All right, I'll try one more time. When we peel back the layers that we don't often want to peel back, when we look at the real heart, is that we don't feel secure ourselves, right? That's exactly what Mark was talking about here. We feel insecure. And so because we don't have a foundation of security within ourselves, we try to grasp it and get it anywhere we can by controlling outside that external locus of control, as Mark put it, right? We try to control our spouse, control other people, control other circumstances, but it's a false foundation. There is no strength behind it. When you try to take that away from someone that's built this up as their coping mechanism to that lack of internal security, they're gonna increase their efforts even more to have more security, and they're gonna try to grab even more control. And so it really becomes a vicious cycle there. And the remedy for you, if you are feeling like, man, this sounds like me, I am striving to control other people because internally, I really don't feel secure, right? And I'll raise my hand and say, that's where this pattern came from for me, was I did not feel secure. And so every time Ben would do something that made me feel like maybe I wasn't so trusting, I'd be the one going through his phone, you know, and doing these kind of things and trying to control where he's going and, you know, what stuff, because it felt very insecure. So I tried to get security by ensuring that he was doing certain things that would make me then somehow feel more secure, but it never worked. The only thing that healed that for me was finally healing that deeper level of insecurity. And then when I was able to build a deeper level of security within myself, those other things became almost non-issues. And if they were to handle them in a healthy manner so that we could both get to the security and the love and the connection we both need. Oftentimes, Mark, we'll hear our clients say, you know, the biggest change that I've had from this whole thing was I went from feeling like I had no control over my life, no control in my relationship, I was feeling like life is just beating me up, to I know who I really am, uncovering who we really are and learning how to bring out the best version of ourselves. When you learn to live from that kind of a state of who we really are, rather than the story that we've made up about ourselves or that life's like shaped for us or our family shaped for us or our society, whatever you want to say, but the story that we ultimately adopted, uncovering the truth of who we really are and living from that state gives you that security, is actually a healthy thing. So let's go about it in the right way rather than trying to get it in artificial ways.
And I like what you're saying there. It's interesting. Like Heather and I are very different people. It's interesting that we're able to work well together. So, I mean, you were just talking about how you yourself were at times that controlling person, and you've had to make some adjustments to get to that healthy state. And what I'm talking about here is, like, I tend to lean on the other end of the spectrum, and I tend to be that person who is a little bit more avoidant, or to feel as though other people are not listening to me if I'm not in that healthy place, if I'm not speaking up for myself. So what do we do about this? How do we work with this dynamic of control, whether you are feeling that control from your partner, because there are behaviors that you need to take responsibility for, even if you're the one that's feeling controlled? Or what do you do if you've come to the realization, hey, maybe I'm that controlling partner, especially if your spouse has been complaining about that kind of issue of control? I do think, like, we go back to that idea of what is the controlling behavior? What is it trying to accomplish? And I think it's that sense of security, that sense that, you know, trying to reduce that anxiety. And I think oftentimes if you can work with the controlling person to create a plan, that would be a really great start. So even if you are the controlling person, say, okay, I need to create a mutually decided upon plan with my partner. Discuss what you're both looking for and discuss a compromise. So, I mean, Heather, you're talking about you yourself being in kind of that, needing that sense of control at some points in your relationship. What would have happened if Ben came to you and said, hey, look, I can see that you're feeling a bit worried about this. I would like to make sure that you feel okay, but I want to make some decisions here myself. Do you think that would have been, most people in a reasonable...
That would have felt amazing to see, wow, he really understands me. And it probably would have been a bit of a wake-up call to me too. Like, oh, wow, you're seeing that I am actually feeling really insecure and seeing that I need more security, but that what I'm doing, this behavior, isn't serving either of those purposes. And now you want to create a plan with me on how we can better do that in healthy ways. That would have lowered my defense mechanisms and really cut to the heart of the problem.
Now, I mean, it's really easy. I do think that a lot of people who are exhibiting this sort of controlling behavior are really unaware of what they are doing. They're going to justify it quite often in some other ways. They're going to say, okay, well, my husband shouldn't be going out with their friends so much. They should be focusing more on their family life. Or there's going to be some sort of sense of right or wrong. Like, this is what is supposed to happen. And so their behavior is then justified. And so denial is quite often the result of that. And just like you mentioned, Heather, you're saying, okay, like, if Ben came to you and said, hey, look, I'm feeling a bit controlled and I'd like to talk about a plan where we can both make some decisions here. I do think that it is very, very important as the person who feels controlled to speak up about it. Not with accusations, not with attacks, but with, I think the healthiest way to bring this up is with I statements. They're a bit cliche, but I think they're very appropriate when confronting unhealthy behavior. And so I statements, just the 5-second recap, is you stick to describing your own feelings and how you feel rather than telling other people what they're doing wrong. So I am feeling controlled right now. I'm feeling like I don't have an ability to make a decision here. I'm feeling like I don't have an ability to have any input. That's really important to describe it in those terms. You know, describe it what's upsetting you, but the focus should be on what healthy needs there are rather than what they're doing incorrectly. And that's what the balance that I like to have. Mm-hmm. Is you do need to inform them with those I statements, but shift the focus to what is wanted. I'm feeling controlled and like I don't have an ability to make a decision, and I would like to be a part of creating this plan here on how to help both of us and how to help you feel more secure. You can manage that. It's, you know, I'm having a hard time thinking of a scenario where if someone is really calm and approaching some controlling behavior like that, where that would be seen as, where there'd be a lot of resistance against that. Mm-hmm. I don't know about you, Heather, but like, it just seems they would have to be in a really stressed, unhealthy state to respond to a very measured and reasonable request like that with an unhealthy response.
Right. And I know a lot of our clients have said, you know, wow, I never thought that conversation would go well because I never really did it in that way. And I wasn't sure if it would work. But then when I did, you know, approach it in this calm, centered way with more of an I statement, my spouse totally opened up.
But yes, as Heather is, yeah. Oh, do we have you back?
Yeah.
Okay. But yes, you're agreeing. this is why it's hard to respond with. It's hard to argue against it. It's because you are basically speaking up for them in their position while at the same time making a reasonable request for your own, like basically an equal, you know, if you're requesting basically equal treatment, it's hard to fight against that. If you're saying, hey, look, I want to respect what you're saying. I want to listen to this. I actually want to consider this. I also want to speak up and talk about my side of things. Most people in a healthy state of mind are just not going to fight against that. If you are encountering resistance with something like that, it tells me that there's probably a lot of static in the communication, meaning like a lot of additional stress, a lot of maybe perhaps health issues. There's other things that are going to be distracting your partner away from having a healthy conversation, and you might need to just revisit that when they are in a better state of mind. But anyways, it's really about that. And it touches on some of the principles that we teach in terms of boundaries. With boundaries, we always start the discussion off with what does each individual need on a basic level in healthy terms. And much like that, we are addressing that in this discussion of control. And you know, then there's this idea, this compromise, how do we both get what we need? And I similarly with boundaries and discussions of control, if your partner isn't in that healthy state and they won't talk about it when you are saying, hey, look, I'm feeling like I can't have any input here. I'd like to be heard. I also want to make sure that you yourself are able to be a part of this plan, and they won't compromise like that. You do need to follow up with some consequences. And the question is always, how do I get what I need, regardless of what my partner provide, whether my partner provides support? This is not punishment. You don't say, well, if you're not going to compromise with me, then I'm not going to talk to you. You might come to that conclusion, but it's always, how do I get what I need if I'm not going to get support? So if you're needing respect, if you're needing to feel heard, what are you going to do about it to gain that respect or to feel like your opinion matters? This is always where I like to sit with boundaries. And I think it applies really well to ongoing controlling behavior like that. So any other thoughts, Heather, before we go into our marriage mythbuster?
Yeah, hopefully I can get one in real quick. Just again, going to the heart of the matter is like, where is that insecurity really coming from? The belief I'm not good enough, I'm not worthy, I can't trust people, people always leave me. All of those things cause us to feel very insecure. And when we feel that, the kind of human instinct is to try to control other people so that then we can gain that sense of security back, which is a sense of security. So whether you're being compelled to do that, and like I did for years and years and years, mostly unconsciously without even realizing I was doing that, or your partner is doing that, give yourself that grace and that compassion that what you're really seeking and what they're really seeking is that sense of security. I do matter. I am good enough. I am worthy. I am lovable. I can trust. I can give. I can have a happy, healthy relationship. And when you get to the root that both of you really, really want that, you'll not only heal your own insecurity, but you'll give space for your partner to heal theirs as well. And that's the kind of deep level root change that we want. There was a really beautiful exercise that we do in our program. And we call it the change your story exercise. And just like I'm tearing down my muscles right now, like kind of obliterating them. So just like I'm tearing down my muscles to build something stronger, we kind of need to tear down our old false stories about ourselves so that we can build the true story about ourselves that we are good enough, we are worthy, we are deserving. And that's a powerful exercise that helps you tear down that old story. It's not serving you. It's causing a lot of grief for you. It's causing you to build a false foundation. And so instead, we're going to tear that all down in a healthy, loving, constructive way and build up the new belief about ourselves. And when you get to that place, that is when you really have that internal locus of control. You have that internal security that we all crave. So, marriage myth buster now. Romance will always be alive in a good marriage. Now, Mark, we seem to be on a bit of a theme. I feel like the past three or four podcasts of this whole idea of there's one and only true love for me. I don't have to work hard for my marriage. It should always just happen naturally. And here's another little bit of a variation on that, that romance will always be alive and good in a marriage. So why is this a myth?
All right, so this is an interesting myth, and it is false in a sense. I'll get into it. The statistics are interesting considering this, because most marriages ebb and flow a bit. Now, specifically, the statistics that I'm considering with this are describing marital satisfaction. And I don't know if any of you have ever looked up charts on this, but there are very clear trends. Essentially, very early on in a marriage, especially in first-time marriages. I'm going to be describing first-time marriages here for the most part. People are married younger, so before they really have their career established, or kids, the satisfaction is very high. You get married, okay, you're getting married for a reason. You like the other person, and there's probably a high amount of romance. What's interesting is there's this very sudden and steady decline for several years, upwards of 5-10 years. Not to say that it's terrible, but the measures on satisfaction take a very big dip. Most people correlate this with developing careers as you gain more responsibilities and introducing children into the mix, because, and this isn't everyone, some people manage that well, but quite frankly, if you have more responsibilities both at work and in the home, it leaves less time for focus on each other. And so you're going to have less of all those lovey-dovey romance sort of actions. Now, interestingly enough, once you start getting into like your 40s, early 50s, it really starts taking a sharp turn upwards in terms of satisfaction. And think about the timing on that. Most people, their career is much more settled. They're in a much more comfortable place financially. And the children have gotten older and are either able to take care of themselves or have moved out of the home. So now your mental load is just a lot less, and it's much easier to focus in on romance and your partner. It's no wonder then that the satisfaction is going to go up. So this is all... Basically, what I'm saying is, I'm equating romance with marital satisfaction. It's not quite equivalent. It is different, but what I'm getting at is the icing, the topping on the cake, in terms of a relationship, tends to be that romance. And it's harder to have all that, the nice parts, the topping on the cake, when you're having to deal with basic needs sometimes, and you're having to change poopy diapers and having to get the dinner on the table. And it's hard. It's much harder and to think about the nicer things. Now, this doesn't say that romance absolutely is dead. If you're in that state, I'm in my, I was gonna be vague about my, no, I'm 37. So I'm kind of in the middle of that era. Heather, I know you are right smack in the middle as well.
Right, exactly. 8 kids, full-time jobs, business running, doing real estate. Yep. Oh my goodness. It's just like, sometimes feels like life is just piling on you, but it's not impossible. It's not impossible. It just means we need to be a little more conscientious and take some actions. And so, Mark, what do you feel like is the best thing that helps while we're in that middle stage to bring that little bit of a spark and to bring some focus back on the relationship to help it thrive?
So I will say that in my relationship, not to say my wife doesn't care about the romantic side of the relationship, but I tend to be the one that is more vocal about it. But, and this is what my recommendation is. If romance is needed, it's important to discuss how you would like romance to happen, how you would like it to look, and to provide support for your partner. Quite honestly, Jen, dealing with our 5 kids who are still fairly young, feels stressed many days. And so when I come to her in the evening, I'm like, okay, let's have this nice romantic evening. She's like, can we just sit on the couch and watch a show? you get the feeling, right?
Right.
I'm sure many of you understand as well out there. And so I have to go to her sometimes and say, hey, look, I would like to feel some extra connection, and I would like to take some time for a romantic evening. We took that time for Valentine's Day over the weekend. It was a very nice day and evening for the two of us. But I recognized that if I wanted that, I needed to provide some support for my wife. So I made, like, for her, for Jen, you know, having the environment really calm was helpful. So I took the initiative and I said, okay, I'm going to organize the kids. We're going to really scrub the house and make this really good and clean. So, you know, that part of it is going to go well. I'm going to set up the atmosphere for our evening together. And so I took the time to do some of those things. And it was very then easy for my wife to step into that situation. And we had, like I said, a very nice time together. But it took me speaking up and recognizing that my wife was stressed. And instead of saying, well, why am I not getting the attention I want? While saying, okay, well, how do we solve this together? And as a result, both of us felt very heard, felt very supported. This is what I think is needed. It does take extra effort if you are in the middle of that responsibility and career and kids section, and if you have less time for each other. But I think it applies at other points, even if you don't have the kids and the intense career.
Right. We've seen this needed in the midlife crisis, the empty nester stage, you know, even going on into the elderly stage. And so it really is about focusing, prioritizing your partner and both of your needs. I feel like so many of us are just running on empty, and we need to be really mindful that we need to fill our own wells first and be aware of what our needs are, and then communicate those to our partner and allow them to communicate theirs to us so we can both support each other in that. And then that's how we really don't just survive life, but we get to thrive and enjoy that icing on the cake, those fun, passionate, romantic feelings.
You have to remember, most people want a connecting romantic relationship. It's not that people are like, nah,
yeah,
whatever. And so we have to approach it from the angle of, if it's not happening, what is going on in that partner's life that might be pulling them away from being able to focus on kind of the higher tier needs?
Right.
I think a good thing to take into account in terms of psychology, this is a very common psychological concept. It's Maslow's hierarchy of needs.
Yep.
People like, you go to psychology 101, you've probably heard about it. But, you know, right down at the bottom, we have like, shelter and food and, water, basic needs. And as you go up higher, you have things like, I'm going to butcher this because it's been a while since I've actually referenced, but I know it's like self-actualization is up at the very top. And I'm going to say like romance is up there. It's going to be up there as well. An ability to be in someone else's life in a positive way. And so you can look at those. What kind of needs are missing that prevent this? And not as in my partner just doesn't care.
Right. Yeah. Change the story there. Awesome, yeah. Mark. Beautiful, beautiful. So I hope that we've smashed that myth. Romance doesn't just always happen. It's going to have its ebbs and flows. And so let's do what we need to do ourselves and then to support our partner in what we both need. All right, so thank you, Mark. Next week, we're going to share with you 4 steps to take when your marriage is in crisis. Now, this is going to be really awesome and exciting. I know a lot of you are saying, yep, that's me. I really want to go deep into how do I turn this around as quickly as possible. So that podcast is going to be for you.
Thanks for listening to The Thriving Marriage, your A to Z blueprint for not just surviving marriage, but thriving. Until next time, my friends, thrive on.